the persona or the personage, if that which is measurable, psychology talks about that projection of the image of ourself and the personality beneath it. And Turnier is doing something different. He's saying that there's something deeper in man than that, that psychology doesn't talk about. And he calls that the person. He says that the personage can be it isn't all bad. It can be a fruit of a meaningful life. It's because we do choose our personage in some way, and we can choose one which has better fruit than worse fruit. He says that also the personage is something that can be the servant of man. It can, it's that group of automatic responses that we can have, which is what Turnier calls the economy of life. That if we had to be, respond, like a new Adam to everything, we just couldn't do it. We have to respond in habitual ways to many things, and it can help us. The personage can help us. And then he says that the personage can also be the grave of the individual. We pick a style. We pick the kind of person we want to be. And then we set about to achieve it. And that can be our grave when we do that. In some ways, he talks about Corot, that Corot did this in his art, and he started copying himself. He started copying himself. He found a successful personage, a successful style, and then he continued to try, all his paintings were done in that style, and he died as an artist. And it's, in writing, that's true too. When you start to copy yourself, your art's dead. And he says that the personage can be really good. It's important. It can also be our grave. He says the job that we have is to bring our personage, that which is measurable, that which other people see, into harmony with the person within. And you can't do that without the person within breaking through of the personage on occasion. Now, he says on page 80, the last two paragraphs, but in this world, full concord between personage and person remains a utopian ideal in this world. Further, by an odd paradox, we approach it only insofar as we become day by day more aware of their constant discord. So we might also say that the progress in our knowledge of ourselves is a progress from uneasiness to uneasiness. The progress in knowledge of ourselves is from uneasiness to uneasiness. It is this gradual feeling our way along a road of discovery rather than a full and complete knowledge of ourselves which bears living fruit. The final reality of the person, always in motion, complex, mysterious, and incomprehensible, still eludes us. Here and there we may catch a gleam of light, a reflection of it, just at those humbling moments when we perceive that we are not what we thought we were. What kind of response to that? We barely got that started with the last outfit. But it is in those humbling moments when we perceive that we are not what we thought we were, that we see the person. And those moments are the moments that bear fruit. The fruit comes from those moments, those breakthroughs of the person, through our personage. Kind of a response. Development of the knowledge about the self is from uneasiness to uneasiness.
John, when we use the word personage, I still can't draw any pictures or nothing comes to my mind. And I guess I'm not clear on the personage.
Okay. Do other people want to look at that some more, just the definition? He defines them roughly in the beginning, he defines his terms, and then the rest of the book continues to define the terms. And then remember I say that insofar as the definition of the person, he has two pages in the last chapter that are a magnificent failure to define it. But the definition, I guess the fullest definition he gives of personage is on in the example of biology chapter. And it's on page 93. Do you want to look at that some more? He says it's three things. In relationship to the person, the personage is three things. It's at first, it's the person's constant fruit. This is what I showed. You find that? In chapter 4. The impossibility of separating the person from the personage, of living at every moment an original and spontaneous life. Because we can't do that. Indeed, we shouldn't do that. To be obsessed with this search for a quite personal originality. Is that people who do that, they resist every external influence for fear of losing their personality. They want to owe nothing to anyone, to have only original thoughts and feelings which no one has experienced before. In the result, however, this turning in upon themselves, depriving themselves of fruitful intercourse with other people, impoverishes their lives and their personalities. What is left of us if we take away everything borrowed from outside and everything that partakes of the nature of habit within us? What happens? A gaping void. I once put it to one of these people like this. We do not do embroidery in the empty air, but on a piece of material. That the piece of material there is the person. This material, like the network of automatism, without which there would be no being, no life, no possibility of embroidery, that is to say, the personal creative activity. That's his, as far as his definition of personage goes, for the personage as fruit of the person.
One way of saying that, meaning it's a facade. Sort of the personage is part of the personage is sort of your facade, your external where people see you at first glance.
Yeah, it is. It is that. One thing that Ternia won't let me do, and I'm glad he won't, because my tendency is to take facade and take the negative connotation of that, and then disparage the personage.
Yeah.
And he won't let us do it, will he? You know, he says that if that's all we've got, then it's worthy of being disparaged. Then we have, our personage becomes our grave. But if there is a dynamic changing of the personage, if we indeed change, if we're living the kinds of lives that we are changing, then he's all for the personage, because as the image I used in class was that you've got to have a cup to hold the water. You take the cup away, the form away, and the water just, you know, dribbles off. In that poem, remember I told the Lifestylers the poem about abandon. We need abandon. We need passion. We need the personal spontaneous response. It keeps the skin taut with heart, but order keeps the blood from running out. You've got to have both. You've got to have
both. The guts kind of need, the building needs a facade too.
Huh?
The building needs a facade too.
Yeah.
Protect it from the elements, so to speak.
That's right. That's right. And that's what he'll say. And if facade is used that way, there isn't the negative connotation. Facade gets a negative connotation when it becomes, when we get our act together, and then that's what we're like. He says the person that you can anticipate what they're how they're going to respond is living a, I mean the personage has become the grave of the person. I think back in the years of getting our heads together, you know, finding out where people's heads are at, I mean for a while there everybody looked like a cartoon. I mean, I remember one fellow in particular that was up here. He was so stereotypical, I couldn't believe him. He either had to be crazy or working for the FBI, because he was so radical. The phrases that they just, you know, it's just phrase after phrase after phrase, and looking like Castro. And we run a danger, particularly in the teens and 20s, I think, out of our own insecurity, to pick an image, to pick a type, and then try to be that type. We might want to be Pat Boone, we might want to be the ingenue, we might want to be, you know, 17, we want, you know, whatever magazines we're reading, we're going to try to take that, a Playboy, and so forth. And insofar as we are successful in projecting that image, Tournier would say the person is dead. That's sort of scary. He does say in one of the chapters that we choose the image. And some of those images are better than others. And I think Tournier would go so far as to say that the best, you know, if you're going to pick, you know, the true human. A name for Christ is the true human. He's the only fully human person, and it would be good to pick somebody fully human if you're going to copy somebody. And the rest is, I mean, I think that's what, when the personage and the person are brought into harmony, not on this planet, there will be that kind of, that humanity will be achieved, not achieved, I think given, but the personage is everything that you can measure of me, you know? You can measure, you can take photographs of me, and you can watch me. Everything that you can say about, you know, the way I am, the type of person I am, is part of my personage.
So can we never begin to talking about the person of another person? Can't we ever hint at talking about the person of another person?
We can experience that, but I don't think we can't really talk a great deal about it, I don't think.
Well, I would think that we would have to be able to find.
That's some of the magnificent, that's some of the greatness of this last chapter. It bothers me too. Last year I had a tremendous difficulty doing the discussion on this book, because I was trying to come up with an ironclad definition of the person. I hadn't read the last chapter carefully enough.
Okay, but can't you talk about another person allowing for the ambiguity or for the mystery? And yet talk about, it just seems like we've got to be able to talk about those close encounters, to those, that personal contact, those training concepts. And we've got to be able to show glimpses that we've seen of the person within a person to each other. Even though language is inadequate, it seems like we still We try to do that,
and I think the way we start to zero in on the person is to look at the many personages that are the individuals involved with. I mean, you get many of them. He says that you don't just have a single personage; you have hundreds of them in different situations. That's one of the problems that we have when we're trying to. When you find out where somebody's head's at, you find out how they react to one in one situation. You don't know them in other situations. That's one of the reasons why you've drawn a cartoon. But if you draw 100 sketches, you can start to sense a little bit more something about the person within.
That's important for us too.
I think it is. He will say that it is very important although we can't ever know the person completely, it is important to move, to try to know ourselves, understand ourselves, the self within. to try to understand other people's. He says it's far more interesting to know all of one person than you know, the surfaces of 100. And that task is something that we should be involved in doing. It makes us pay attention to people. It makes us change our minds about people. And that is important. However, language, when we go about to describe somebody, we describe by types. And in a sense, we're destined to be essentially talking about personages in terms of description. In some ways, Tierney almost says that the person is revealed between people. Between people. The person is dialogue, he says. That's a really strange line. The person is dialogue.
Yeah. At one point he says, in his other book, To Understand Each Other, that self-knowledge never comes through introspection. It can only come through dialogue.
Yeah, that's right. And did it only...
He also talks about establishing personal contact with his readers through his writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that it's not just in the meeting of two physical people right here.
Now, dialogue can take place without that kind of situation, yeah. Dialogue with God can take place without the name of God, Tierney will say too. Says any search after value, what is valuable, is dialogue with God. It's sort of a revolutionary little line. Any search after value is dialogue with God. And but what I'm saying, I guess what I'm hinting at, or not, I'm not hinting at anything because I don't have any answers here. But when it seems like Tierney is saying that the person is something that is seen in dialogue. The person is dialogue. It's something between us rather than, that's how we see it. We see it between us. We can't look in and see it. We see it between us. It's something that's a little bit like that statement that wherever two or three are gathered, I am among you. The Holy Spirit. Wherever two or three are gathered, I am there. He does say that perhaps the meeting of, this meeting of persons can only happen with two or three people. As soon as more people start to come around, we start to be more personages. It's an interesting thing.
He says even three is really...
The chances are very diminished at three.
Because then you have I think he used the word galley.
Got a galley.
You have to go down the shore, in a sense.
Yeah. That's right. And, it's... He goes on, he says that the personage can be the fruit of the person. It can be the servant of the person. And he talks about the automatisms are an economy of consciousness. That's his line. That's on page 94. He says, we have to do things automatically many times. Our organs actually work much better when we leave them to their automatic functioning and do not think about them. Simply because the man's mind occupies itself with his body. He talks about the hypochondriac there, but that our automatic responses are, the automatic responses of the personage are part of the economy of consciousness because we cannot be conscious of everything and do anything. And if anyone knows that from first-hand experience, it's me. There was a time in my life when one doctor said, I took in Minnesota multiphasic thing, and he said, "My goodness, you're conscious of everything." And that was, that was a time when some doctors said I had a, was crazier than a loon. And the other doctor said I wasn't crazy at all, but it was, I was conscious of everything. And you can't do anything. I was in a nut house at the time. And when you're conscious of everything, you're, everything inside you, everything outside you, you're non-functional, you know. And in a sense, it was part of that was a great deal of honesty, because on the same test they said, this guy's being so honest, it hurts. And it came out of a desire not to be, but to be false, and to respond originally to everything. And you go crazy. And he does say, you can't do that. And so I know about this one. Then the third thing that the personage is, in relationship to the person, is that it can be the person's grave. Which is, when we say of someone that he has an extremely lively personality, we mean he is full of creative imagination, of unexpected caprices, and unforeseen whims. All this is the very opposite of the automatic. Those humdrum lives that I've been describing in this book seem already dead before their time, before physiological death arrests the working of the mechanisms of body and mind, which are, so to speak, the only things left alive in them. The liveliness of the child comes of his not yet having, like the adult, been subjected to the inexorable world of automatism. His spontaneity is contagious and makes us feel freer, as if the too close-fitting garment which was constricting us had been loosened. When a man becomes set in a rigid mode of thought and habit, we feel that he has grown prematurely old, that life is being extinguished in him. He always repeats the same formula of word and action. His reaction to every situation can be foreseen. He is nothing more than a well-trained animal. Indeed, it is not what is really human, but the merely animal in us that is automatic. And sometimes we choose that. That's the irony. I think in many ways success in the world's terms comes from a life where you have, it is basically automatic. And if that's what happens to us, then he says on the top of the next page, but if that's all there is in me, I am not a man. He says that which in the middle of it, in 96, he says that which is properly so, this is action properly so called, truly spontaneous and creative. And as such, it remains isolated, unique and unforeseeable, and so impossible to study scientifically. The person is like that. It is a manifestation of the person thrusting aside the personage, but it will become in its turn the source of a new set of automatic reactions. It's an interesting thing. We experience these breakthroughs in our life. Something new comes into the way we do things, and pretty soon that breakthrough becomes habit, a new way of responding to people, and then pretty soon that becomes our habit. And there has to be a kind of a continual breaking through. Come out, Lazarus, come out, Lazarus, come out, Lazarus, come out, Lazarus. I think that it's very important that we hear that again and again and again and again. That's where the life comes, the life of the Spirit. And then he says at the end of that last chapter, each of those breakthroughs comes at a time when we find out we weren't who we said we were. And it comes from humbling experiences. When our heart breaks, when we're ashamed, that's when the breakthroughs come. They said from Psalm 51, the broken and contrite heart God will not despise. Why? Well, gee, the broken and contrite heart is that breaking open of the personage to where the river can flow again, that there can be something new happen in my life. And how can then this new life be a movement from uneasiness to uneasiness? That's strange. Every creative event, every resurgence of life comes to upset the established order of the routine automatism. But it immediately gives rise to new ones, which take the place of the old. It would seem that then there is a sort of rhythm of life between its stereotyped forms, which are alone observable, and the intangible pulsations which save it from imprisonment within them. The person is manifested in those intermittent flashes, whereas all that is continuous in us is personage. All that is continuous in us is personage. It is that the tension between the personage and the person, back on 80, the tension that always exists between the person and the personage is one of the conditions of our life, and we must accept it. It is part of the nature of man. Indeed, it is what makes him a man. It's what makes him a man, this tension.
I have to get a drink of water.
One of the ironies of this whole thing is none of this is self-conscious. None of it. Remember the time, maybe you've gone through the time when you wanted to be spontaneous. None of this real birth of the person is something that you're conscious of, self-conscious of. It's in a sense you discovered that it's happened. Maybe you never discover it's happened, but other people experience it. Maybe you never discover it. But it's not something that you can self-consciously set about to achieve. What would you do if you self-consciously did it? What would you do? You'd pick the personage of the spontaneous individual. And then you would be inflicting that on everybody. And you know when you've done it, if you've done it, that it isn't you. No way is it you. I want to be more lively. Okay, lively people look like this. Okay, and then I go out and, you know, and it just does not work. That, I guess, is the irony of the whole, part of the irony of the whole thing is that it isn't self-conscious. It's like you discover that it's, and maybe you don't discover, but it's something that happens. It's an event. Well, if it's so important that the person keep breaking through the personage, then what does one do? What does a person, I mean, if it's that important, what does, it does, is there something that Turnier would say encourages that?
I don't remember exactly where it says it, but that the prisoners that God would have us have.
Where is that? Well, your book is the wrong.
That's the wrong. I think it's on like 74 and something. After he talks about that enemy, he talks about waiters before. The efforts we are vainly making to isolate our person completely from our personage, it substitutes quite a different idea, that of accepting the clothing which God himself gives us, of choosing our personage, the personage that God wills us to have. And then it seems to me that the place where the person breaks through a personage is when we experience the impossibility of that.
Say that harmony? Say that again, that last part.
Okay, the question is, what are we supposed to do? And Turnier suggests that we try to choose the personage that God would like us to have, that God gives us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just what he says at the end, that because of this world, we'll conquer between the personage and the person, and the person remains a utopian ideal. And so at those moments of realizing that we can't put on that personage that God gives.
You're right on.
Oh, okay. Then those are the moments.
That's right. Because of the nature of the personage that we put on, we're guaranteed the glimpses of finding out that we weren't who we thought we were. Any other, you know, the smaller, anything smaller, we can go for a long time without recognizing that we weren't who we said we were. I thought we were. But if I take on the personage that the personage God wills us to have, it's an interesting thing happens. There's sort of a bang there because you say, oh, individuality, the way I understood it, and originality, the way I understood it, doesn't have anything to do with this. That is sort of a, do you feel that sort of shock at this point? Individuality and originality doesn't have anything to do with this in a conscious way. To pick the personage God wills us to have, the sense of the put on the new man born of the Spirit that is already given. And is it in a sense that the only true originality and individuality comes that way, unconsciously? It's a big, again, like trying to be a spontaneous person. You can't do it.
I mean, in a way, I feel like, okay, read a lot of this stuff and understand it, and then just trust that your unconscious will remember it and conscious will forget it all.
Well,
I mean, that you know, if I start trying to figure out which person I'm wearing now, and which,
yeah,
and when I'm actually having a personal encounter with somebody,
yeah,
and all this, I've become such a phony, I can't stand myself.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've lived that for a good bit of time,
yeah,
from junior high on, and mm-hmm, decided I had to make a radical change,
mm-hmm,
and try out different things.
Yeah.
I think a lot, you know, many of us have done that, but so I think it's good to know what games we're playing, but then also that you become more yourself when you're thinking about yourself less. It was like that Vespers that Carol Lenderly gave with, from the Circle of Quiet, that the child playing, that's the totally unselfconscious act, he's totally immersed in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several other examples too, and that when someone, when you're writing a poem, or you're painting a picture, you're outside of yourself,
mm-hmm,
and you're most you,
mm-hmm,
and you're least self-conscious. Consciousness-raising stuff.
How do you get to that point, though? I mean, because to be unself-conscious, why aren't we unself-conscious?
Well, we can't be totally unself-conscious. Why aren't we unself-conscious?
Mm-hmm.
Because we keep trying to put ourselves in this kind of universe.
That's, yeah, that's part of it. In our own reverie, we see ourselves at the center of the universe. But why do we when the person breaks through the personage, I have dialogue with God or with other people. That is important. That comes through recognizing my weakness. Now why, what keeps me from allowing that to happen?
Is that the same question as why are we so conscious? Sorry, we'll answer that with, when we worded it, why are,
yeah,
we so conscious?
Well, I did a double negative or something in there.
I'm thinking of the Genesis, the Adam and Eve story of the fall. They were totally unself-conscious until they tried to gain full knowledge.
That's right. The sense that what happened in the fall was this self-consciousness happened in the fall. We became self-conscious. And So that's the state we're in. But why do we... I don't know if I am asking the same question. Why do we resist? Yeah, in a sense it is. Why do we resist self-forgetfulness? In a sense, we've jumped to the obstacle chapter, haven't we? That we're going to talk about tonight. Right? The obstacle to dialogue. Dialogue, the person is a dialogue. Then you have the chapter on the dialogue, and then you have the obstacles in the dialogue. And what are those? What are the obstacles? Is an obstacle? Is it? Say some more about that.
Afraid to show our weakness. Bring to view our fault, our weaknesses.
So that would be almost the contrary of what you're saying, in that we fear showing that we don't have much to be proud about. Is that? And that's what you would be saying, the weakness. We fear showing that we don't have a great deal to be proud about.
That's pride.
Pride? Mm-hmm. Pride?
Isn't that more like shame?
What's pride?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. What's pride? Now, you get down to these basic questions and you make me want to run for cover.
My
child,
tell us.
I don't know.
That's
what is pride? I associate pride with arrogance. And now, what's arrogance? Thinking I'm more than I am.
Well, that's not the same thing as wanting to show yourself as more than you are.
Right, because if you get down to the root of thinking that you know more than you do,
mm-hmm.
doesn't it come down to knowing nothing?
Yeah, but you're not aware of it.
Right. So, but today, basically, it's just your level of awareness. Mm-hmm. Shame would be a closer awareness.
I don't know. I think you're making sense. It's not, you know, I'm not managing to come up with any kind of a synthesis of what's been said yet. But what each person has said has made sense.
Shame seems more honest.
Right. Yeah. They will. What would, if you were proud, what would you fear about showing? Would you fear anything showing? Showing yourself?
You're showing what I truly am.
You're showing weakness.
Yeah. Well, that's the bend back to what I had said about the opposite of. Well, I said that what Carla said about fearing to show weakness would be an opposite to what you had said. Pride is the thing. Now, it could very well be that pride keeps us from.
I see it as keeping us from showing weakness.
Okay.
You can't be proud of their opposite.
Yeah.
A proud person wouldn't be afraid of showing anything.
Yeah.
What have I got? I've got me. I'm not afraid of you.
I see arrogant as a part of pride. The thing is, I see arrogant one wouldn't be afraid of showing anything. And that pride can come in both the strong reactions and the weak reactions.
Pride.
And that Arrogance is a very strong, you know, it's the cover-up with reaction, but it's pride. It's pride. Whereas fear of showing one's weakness is a weak reaction, but that comes out of pride too.
Yeah, like if you're, it's like you're vain. Just to put in another term, you can think more.
Yeah.
But I mean, if a person thinks that they're really beautiful, and is very proud of that, of their beauty, and takes, then isn't part of that also being afraid that someone will think that they're not, or of showing a part of them that isn't? Is that part of the vanity?
I'm having real trouble.
I argue that the proud person couldn't admit to the possibility that anyone could doubt it. How could it be doubted? It's so obvious.
Yeah.
I see that as one half of pride. And say the other half of pride is fear of showing one's weakness.
Yeah.
And that's the weakness.
Like the desire to...
There's no such thing as an honestly proud person.
Yeah.
There's always a weak on your side.
I think, in essence, we're weak, and that out of that weakness, we either act in what you call proudly and arrogantly, and want to cover it up with strong reactions and say, no, we're not weak, and, I mean, aggressively, or out of that weakness, we flee from it just as much, fleeing from that weakness is to cover it up with those strong reactions, but we can also flee from those that weakness by weak reactions, and that's I see that's a pride too, and that's where we're, you know, also run away from that shame.
I think that thing happens, but I'm not sure that's pride.
It's a kind of thing, a desire to save face. I think that desire to save facade, the desire to save face, to nurse the reputation, as Tournier says, is that is what we're talking about, whether we're getting together or not, I think. But we desire... We don't want to lose face. And using Karn's word, we don't want to lose facade. And what other things besides that keep us from... keep us from breaking out of our personage? Besides the desire to save face.
Well, fear, just any kind of fear.
Well, I think fear is the major category. In Tournier's work, at least the Tournier I've read, fear is the enemy. And then there are different manifestations of that fear. And we fear what? What do we fear? Embarrassment, he says. I mean, I'm going to do something stupid if I am not in control of myself in my situations with other people. Unless I'm thinking about control, but unless I'm self-conscious, I'm going to make an ass out of myself. Is that something that Tournier would say? Is one of the reasons, one of the things that keeps the person locked in the person? It's another manifestation. If I open up to people, it's a great risk. It's a great risk, isn't it? What?
No, I have proof for our connection.
Okay, say it.
I don't remember the exact thing, but if one should say laying their hand on the floor, what is it?
That is not what I meant at all. That is not it at all.
Yeah. I'm afraid of what we say being misunderstood. serve achievement.
Yeah.
We're afraid of what we mean being understood.
When we are so insecure, why are we so afraid of showing weakness? It's something we talked about a little bit in the Proof Rock discussion. We were talking about all this. Everybody saw themselves in Proof Rock. And why do we do it? I mean, you can't, in a sense, in a discussion where there are more than two people, you can't really have person-to-person contact according to Ternia, but what can be done?
Oh,
What? You can knit. What? What?
Knit all the person-to-person together and...
When you can't learn without criticism, why do we fear criticism so much? I mean, I said things before, you know, go to college and find the best criticism you can find. You know. And that's what you're paying the bucks for. Find the best.
And we don't want to know ourselves. We don't want to lie to ourselves. And we don't want anyone to show us that we're deceiving ourselves. As long as we're deceiving ourselves, we don't need to know about it. Self-deception can only be broken by someone else.
I don't know what Ternier would say, but I know why I don't want it.
But
because that, I'm the one that has to pick and choose how I'm going to change. And if that same person is shown to be sadly deficient, then there's no hope for me.
Say that again, I missed
it. I went to seminary from here because I thought that I learned some stuff here that would mean I could go into seminary and take a positive poll of what was going on there. Now, when I ran into a professor who didn't apparently have any respect for my past experience, but instead covered my paper with all sorts of writing and red ink, I could... you can read that.
Yeah.
Because if he demolished what I had written down, then what hope do I have of becoming wise?
Yeah, that was that you're telling what your thought at the time was, right? Okay, what's your thought now?
I still think I'm hardly able to accept criticism for the same reason. Because I can hardly trust that there's anything around that, you know, is going to take care of me if I can't take care of myself. I can hardly do that. I can sometimes let it happen if it's happening through the clear funnel of Scripture because I trust that. But I hardly, like in that class there, I could say about him that he was a professor of philosophy, which he was. And I was suspicious.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a proclamation situation. It was a situation of comparing philosophies, and I could hold it off. Maybe I was right and he was wrong, but that wasn't the point. Maybe he was right, that was the point.
Yeah. You know, one of the ironies is just the teacher, you know how good he thought that paper was in order to write on it like that? a bad paper, you cannot think of anything to say. That's one of the ironies. The better the paper is, the more I can say about it. The more I can disagree with it. The more I can check it. Or I can say, think about this, think about this. But a D paper, an F paper is zero. You can't even come to terms with a D. Maybe you can, but it's embarrassing to write anything because the argument is so vapid that you can't, you just can't meet it. you can say some things about an average paper, you know, but a B, A paper, almost excellent paper, but maybe off track, you know, really excellent, but something else other than the guy asked for, you know, which is probably your case, you know, in this thing. But the thing is that the paper, see, if it's a bum paper, the guy won't even look right. He won't know what to say. He won't know how to come to terms with it. See? If a person communicates so poorly, you can't. I mean, you can't write any comments on it. So think about that, Smith. You know? I used to surprise people in rhetoric because they said that the A paper, you wouldn't have anything to say about it. Well, the A paper is communicated well enough to where we can have dialogue. We can talk. We can disagree. Do you almost start to laugh nervously sometimes when you think how we resist almost everything that provokes growth in us? The nervous laugh, you know. I mean, I do when I see how crafty that little bastard devil is to make me resist exactly what is, you know, makes me grow. The growth of the person comes from uneasiness to uneasiness. Jesus Christ has spared me from uneasiness. I have to be. See? We can actually use the gospel to keep growth from happening.
That's the most effective way.
Yeah, it is. As I characterize it, you know, the last best refuge from God is religion. It's a tremendous quote.
Would that be like you saying tonight that I can't use the gospel and the cosmic okay?
Yeah. Because that takes everything that he's talking about, the dynamics of our life, out. And we can sit in a situation like this, and the irony in the proof rock thing, we can sit in a situation like this and talk about this weakness and all accept that we have these fears and everything like that. And we're open and we just nod our heads, yeah, that's it. We can walk out of here and before we get up to the dining hall, we're doing it again. Now that is, I mean, that's terrible how deeply that's ingrained in us. I mean, I can fear not being accepted. I can fear not being accepted and then project a self that is not me, that is accepted, and I'm not accepted, and I'm glad. Wait a minute. Does that make sense? I fear not being accepted and so project something that isn't me, that is accepted. I'm not accepted. And we're living more lie. We're living in the lie, like in the sense that we got caught to serve a lie. And we didn't even get anything for it. Watch bedazzled. You know, now pay attention to bedazzled when it comes. It's funny. But we give up our soul and don't get anything. We have a sense of that we're not smart as we should be. And then we fear criticism. And that's the thing that helps us be a little, know a little more.
And so from there too, we also fear to give criticism.
Vicious circle, yeah.
I mean,
It's like, it's very hard to find a school where you can get good credits. Because we don't say that anything's wrong, we don't say that anything's bad, we don't say that anything needs improvement. It's much easier to tell somebody that's okay than to say, why don't you fix this sentence and why don't you do this? Well, what you were talking about one night in terms of being preferring to be a contentless comrade than a friend.
What was that? Contentless.
You were talking about working with group home and preferring to be a Bruce Thompson.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, anyway, you were saying that how much easier it is to be a comrade without contact in a relationship than to be a friend with the contact and taking those risks.
Yeah.
And that ties in with...
Takes time. It takes time to be a friend. I mean, in a sense, remember what Fritz said, the best thing you can do for people is love them, the next best thing, hate them, the worst thing you can do is ignore them. And yet many of the ways, the things that I can take to be the proper way of dealing with other people is to really, essentially, ignore them. If I don't want to be bothered by you, I'll say, oh, you're okay, yeah, that's okay.
And yet we're caught in a situation where we could pretty much, we do have to do that. Some of the time. I mean, you have to move automatically.
Yeah. But you don't have to philosophically put everybody in a situation where okaying everybody. It's in a sense, you'd think a friend would pay attention to what you say. Yet sometimes we can choose friends that don't. And if they do listen to what they say and respond to what we say, then we can say, well, get off my case. What kind of a friend are you? And I can't let somebody do their thing unless I don't care about them. Hey, remember we talked once years ago, Years ago. Gosh. I remember walking down that night. It makes me cry just to think of it. That was just... Geez, it was hard to come down here. And the hell I could the hell with Keith, But there are things like that. And there's a funny thing about Keith, I don't know anything about Keith. We talk more down there just, where are you from? I didn't even know where you're from. You don't know where I'm from or anything like that. The sense, too. You know me more than a lot of people do. I know you more than a lot of people do, and yet we've never had what normally looks like conversation. I don't think in years. And yet there is that kind of... I don't think put it into words, but I think Keith knows my person better than anyone in the lifestyle program, and I've spoken to you guys much more. You've seen me much more. That's crazy. That's not crazy, that's absurd, that's neat. One of the crazy things about that thing was that I was weak and Keith was weak. That's how our relationship started, wasn't it? I mean, you were in a weak position, I was in a weak position, and there was no bullshit about that. And we had this meeting of first. Meeting of persons. Well, shit. I mean, after that, I don't have to know where even Tommy's from.
That's really true. You don't. It's funny how we try to grip a hold of something to organize.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. When you have a vague idea where someone really is coming from, and it doesn't do any good to know what town they're from, because you're not going to be able to keep them in line that way anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And one of the crazy things, that business of it coming out of weakness. You know, coming out of weakness. I mean, now we've laughed at how well the devil's got us by the short hairs. Now we can start to laugh a little bit about how God turns us in our greatest weakness and takes, in the forgiveness of sins, even takes sin and turns it into our life, the greatest part of our life, and takes weakness and turns it into closest contact between people. And take something that, in the world's terms, is nuts, and bring out of that, come out with new life. Now that God's shrewd too. It isn't just the devil that's shrewd.
Yeah, like in the Gospel of John, of course, it was at the Pontius Pilate's at the trial. I think it was his wife or something that was. Was it his wife was objecting to what Pontius Pilate was going to do, and that was the devil that was objecting.
That's one of the people's theories.
Because the devil didn't want Christ.
Where is this?
And so God fooled the devil by having by not letting Pontius Pilate listen to his wife. It was the devil in his...
The devil didn't realize it yet.
It was the devil in Pontius Pilate's wife who was trying to stop Pontius Pilate from having Christ killed. And just how that...
Where was this?
God tricked the devil to begin with. Because the devil's natural reaction would be to kill Christ. I mean, that's what he would think. And the devil didn't realize until too late that that was exactly what God wanted.
Have where did you get this stuff? No. I mean, where was it from?
Gary.
Is it from Gary?
Well, it was one of the theories, I think, or one of the explanations that people
would
come up with about that.
Yeah. Well, that might be. I mean, you know, it sounds kind of interesting, but it's something I haven't ever. You know, is this in the Aquarian Bible?
Well, it just reminded me because he was, in a sense, the devil brings us down and makes us immobilizes us in a way, and makes us. Lie. He just feeds us our living lie.
Yeah.
And is out of that weakness when we're really down there, that's where God takes us.
Yeah.
And that's where we're able to start from. And in a sense, that's tricking the devil.
Yeah, but there is something else. Like I can say fear of criticism. I can fear criticism. That's the true story. I can fear criticism, but the devil tells me that something else. See, he doesn't. I mean, he then tells me that I'm you can't criticize me. Or he'll tell me something like I've got a right to my opinion. Or he'll tell me that turkey doesn't know what he's talking about. Or something like that. And that I do. You see? Fear of criticism isn't going to manifest itself in fear of criticism. You're going to cover it somehow, and I think the devil is going to help you justify your calling fear of criticism by another name. Usually you call the guy that you is most in a position to criticize you a real turkey, one way or another. And that's how that manifests. And I think that Christ, in a sense, I mean, the devil doesn't want us to know how much we fear criticism, because then we might start to think about how dumb some of this is. You know, but I mean, I remember that Vespers. I don't know, you weren't here. The Vespers on the Good News You're Dead Vespers I did last year. In that sense, that God, you know, the devil, it offers He wants to keep fear away, you know, and only occasionally scare the hell out of us. He wants to keep our death always at the back of our minds and always over the horizon. And he wants us to keep us to think that life on this earth is a childish task. It's easy. Life is an easy thing. And only occasionally will he show us that it isn't that way. Well, that argument that I did in that Vespers was much too long to talk about tonight, because it was more like an essay than a Vespers. But there are some interesting things there to look at. I think I got some copies of it. But we fear we will be embarrassed. And yet, in the Old Testament, before God turns his back, what does he say? And the last thing he says about the people of Israel before he says, I'll turn my back on them, he says, you have forgotten how to blush. Mm-hmm. That is the damnation. We talked about this a bit.
Did you say that?
Huh? No. It's in Jeremiah. No, is it in Jeremiah?
I just thought that sounded really neat.
Yeah, it's in Jeremiah, I think. Jeremiah or Isaiah. You have forgotten how to blush. And that blushing is finding ourselves to have been something other than we thought we were, which is the crack in the heart, the broken and contrite heart, through that crack the river of life starts to flow again. All this stuff. And yet, did you ever live like that consciously? There's nothing to be ashamed about. You know, I was 18 when I was doing that. There is nothing to be ashamed about. And I set about producing enough things, luckily, because of certain intensity, in about 3 weeks. I was embarrassed as hell, so that stage was very short-lived. But for a while, it looks like that there's nothing to be embarrassed about. You don't have to be embarrassed. We're in a new age, and so forth. We've got a lot to be embarrassed about. And indeed, when we try to, through some philosophy, keep away from being ashamed, we're sort of putting the hammering in the nails on the coffin, aren't we? The coffin of the person.
I think possibly, though, that particular moment of feeling that there's nothing at all to be embarrassed about, or nothing to fear, nothing, you know, there's really no shame. It's really not just something you're wishing for, but something that you really feel deeply can be a real gift, because then you act on it. I did. In my own way, and it's better than just wishing that you could feel that way.
Yeah.
I actually believe it.
Yeah.
And try it. Yeah. And God save us from going too far, you know. But it's instructive. It was instructive.
Which was?
Well, you know, I've made a real fool of myself in several ways, acting on that, you know, assumption. And there were some people around to point it out. Which forced, you know, another reevaluation hard on the heels of that first one. That was good.
Really good. Yeah.
They cleared out an awful lot of stuff awfully fast. There was still an awful lot of stuff left. In fact, in a sense, there was more than there had ever been before.
Yeah. But it does. I mean, when it catches up with you, you really, whoop. There is a sort of a spring cleaning that happens. I wonder, I guess something maybe to say now. I don't, what time is it getting?
Nine.
Something Tournier says here that is really interesting. I think after talking about things the way we have, this will make sense. I don't think at the beginning of this session it would have made that much sense. But he does say that we are all afraid of reality. We pretend we want to know ourselves, and we are afraid of knowing ourselves. We pretend we want to know ourselves, and we're deathly afraid of knowing ourselves. It is not only the picture that other people have of us that we are afraid of having to revise, but also the picture that we ourselves have of other people. We substitute then the fatal pretension of knowing ourselves and knowing our neighbors. The fatal pretension of knowing ourselves and knowing our neighbors. There is something strange in me that would rather have you as an enemy than leave you alive. And that's shooting it to it, and that's the hyperbolic state, exaggerating state. If I can call you an enemy, I'm more comfortable than if I have to face your ambiguity. Does that make sense? And all the time I can kid myself and say that what I'm doing is in the name of life, you know, and truth. And it really is strange. Now that, afraid of knowing ourselves to be, we fear reality, afraid of, we say that we want to know ourselves and we fear knowing ourselves as being exactly the kind of people that Christ says over and over and over, those kind of people he came to save. You know. And yet I can read the Bible and put it down and walk out and try disassociate myself from the knowledge that I am Mary Magdalene. I'm these people. And that's nuts. You know, that's crazy. It's normal. It's natural. But it's crazy. You know, really is crazy. You hit it on the head, though, Keith, on trust. You know, we don't really trust. We don't really believe we're forgiven, usually, and we don't trust. And therefore, we fear. It's very hard for me to sing that thing in the matins about, you know, I have trusted in thee, we have trusted in thee. I get the creeps every time I sing that. I am not trusted in Christ. And in a sense, I feel guilty about that, but man, if I don't react that way at that point, I better watch out. Do it?
I got another spot.
Yeah,
I'd like to let me never be confounded.
I think you might be saying something. I can't remember exactly the way Gretchen, yes. You and I are talking, something about the immense. The irony is that there it takes an immense shalom, help, to recognize weakness. Man, it takes a lot. And that recognition of weakness is the health of the creature. In the world's terms, it's weakness. in the kingdom terms, and I always insist on a double kind of language, just to help us understand what we're talking about. It's the, in the beatitude reality, in the kingdom reality, that the world says is weak, is our help and strength coming through that. And so in a sense, there's the strength of weakness.
Yeah, I guess what I'm thinking of is this, the moment in and of itself is, to me, a kingdom moment, you know, to point it that way, but it's so much more than the revelation of all the intensity of your emotions felt at any one moment. I guess I was just flashing on to the picture talking about, wow. And I was talking about dress last night in terms of how it affected me, you know, shivering in the corner at times. Or just, you know, that was the first time I knew that I was stoned, was when I realized I was paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, I'm normally not paranoid, and I want to just sit in this bed here, you know, hang my head down and just, you know. Whatever that weird sensation that keeps you going and smoking after you realize that, I don't know, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
But I was thinking of the actual state of the shivering, and even it being one particular moment where it was real strong, and maybe that was a moment where I decided in my head that's it, because my closest girlfriend was in the same state at the same time, and that was a real utter moment of weakness. Okay, me sitting in the corner shivering by myself, for someone else to empathize and be there. They wasn't reaching to God enough. I don't feel that that was a dialogue that might have been to other people, a real revelation of my utter emotions at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But with that girlfriend, when the two of us were equally weak,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. there was a strength that was born out of that that then carried me through. Mm-hmm.
I might just be getting sleepy. I'm having some trouble with the language.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's experiences that you know, there is an experience of the miracle when you lose everything that you thought you needed to be in relationship, and you find that you're in relationship with more than you have ever been before. Does that make any sense to your situation? I don't know if I can. You know, there is a sort of a miracle of when you lose everything that you think you needed in order to exist and to be in relationship, and you find yourself in a closer relationship with reality than ever before. I know in my own fears and the things that I feared, you know, I valued intelligence and I valued imagination and I valued function. And there's a lot of farm boy in me, and that to be able to function under all circumstances and to take tremendous weights and to be conscious I valued all sorts of things. And when I was in the hospital, I lost everything, you know, everything I feared losing I lost, and I had one of the realest moments of my entire life when everything I feared happened. And it was a much better, realer moment. And from then, it was just a matter of time to get up and out of there. You know, I feared losing my capacity. I lost it. And I haven't had to be afraid of what many people, I think, spend their whole lives fearing. I was really lucky to, at 20, to have lost everything but my life. I was really lucky. You've got something there.
Oh, I just, when you said that about the servitude, mine is in the glory and it shelters. We praise thee, we bless thee, we worship thee, we glorify thee.
Yeah. I praise me, I bless me, I worship me.
Yeah. I maybe I think maybe that's the way I've been doing it too. I've been putting an eye there. Maybe I can simulate by saying wait. Yeah. It must be the church that does it.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't, I haven't been singing it because I couldn't because I was saying, singing I.
Yeah.
Does that remind me of
I think that's a good point about we, the church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Because there is something we do together that we can't do alone and keep a straight face. And we need each other. And it's funny, it's every Sunday we it's how much we resist saying that Satan has played fast and loose, you know, with our life. And yet every Sunday we say that. But every Monday I'll punch you out if you say that Satan is pulling the strings in my life. You know, boy, you're in trouble. You see? And yet, dang it, we say it every Sunday. That's some of why I think it's important to bring, I don't want to be morbid, but bring the concrete image of sin into church. Don't feel like church is a place where you've got to leave dirty thoughts outside. If you have something that you really in your life that is just really something, bring it in. It's the context of meaning of what's going on for that whole service. And then again that dream, that sense of when you know you're forgiven, it's a different, you know. Criticism becomes that I told about that dream, the Vespers before last, about the dream of having the voice tell me what I out my sins, and it was the pure joy. You know, just pure joy. Oh, great! Because in my dream, I really did care about people more than I cared about myself. So, what is a better gift than to know what I've done that has hurt people? And I remember this experience when I got to the graduate writing school at Iowa. First week, scared to death. These guys, I thought, I was used to dodging, you know, people shooting at me with pea shooters, and I got down there, and those guys are firing howitzers off at you, you know. This criticism this guy gave you of your thing. And I kept saying, you're talking so much. They responded the same way. I was very neurotic that first year. I almost left because the teachers cared so much about what I was saying that they wanted me to say. They respected my poem more than I did, and they were responding a great deal to it. And I thought that meant it was a crummy poem. Never realizing until a few months later that they were some... what other people thought of them was so much more than I thought of them. I couldn't believe it. But that feeling of joy to get somebody who's a good critic. And finally, somebody that can help me with this stuff. Yeah. Well, there are a lot of things that this, the sense of perfect love casts out fear from 1 John is so great. And Christ is perfect love. And casting out fear, and boy, I know fear is something that I has written all through my autobiography and will be in the future, but hopefully I can pray more specifically about it and about the things that we've talked about tonight. We'll go on and on this Friday, great chapter. I don't know if we'll ever even get past the world of persons and the world of things. I hope to be talking on that last section of the book. But there's that beautiful statement of laying oneself open to life. Laying oneself open to life that is so super. And that's the first chapter, the world of persons and the world of things. And I thought, you know, I thought I'd say something just in light of that chapter, because I hope that we read, you know, that, well, I imagine you all read that one at least, but I hope all the rest, you know, that last section of the book. But something about that chapter of laying oneself open to life, and something about to sort of throw into the discussion of, the discussion that starts in talking about drugs, but goes far beyond that. And this is just a little quick statement, just to throw into there to think about. To lay oneself open to the creation is important for us to experience, because it signals an important spiritual rebirth within us. To want the experience of being laid open so much that we will artificially find artificial means to achieve it is to ignore and bypass the spiritual rebirth that God wants for us. God waits to gift us with an experience of embracing reality. To want the psychological experience of transcendence without the spiritual rebirth that gives our lives a spiritually transcendent event is a problem that has plagued insecure man for eons. To want the feeling of communication without its substance is another manifestation of the same problem man has with reality. We can get the feeling of communication by not really listening to what we say or others say, not caring enough to disagree. Our conversation can then deteriorate to various equivalents of mellow and groovy, or eventually to sighing yas. And then, of course, we have to be only talking to those people who agree with us. I am always troubled with the question, how could I respect myself if the best moments of my conversation or best visions were none of my doing, and the only congratulations for the psychological experiences were due to a chemical? Even if I am a religious sort of chap and say praise the Lord under the influence, I must know that I am misplacing the praise, and to be accurate, must praise the only variable, the chemical. It's just something to throw into the discussion on this stuff.